Matthew 17, verse 1 through 9 and 14 through 20. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and his brother John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became dazzling white. Suddenly there appeared to them Moses and Elijah talking with him. Then Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will make 3 dwellings here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." While he was still speaking, suddenly a bright cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud a voice said, "This is my son, the beloved. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell to the ground and were overcome by fear. But Jesus came and touched them, saying, "Get up and do not be afraid." And when they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus himself alone. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus ordered them, "Tell no one about the vision until after the Son of Man has been raised from the dead." When they came to the crowd, a man came to him, knelt before him, and said, "Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is an epileptic and he suffers terribly. He often falls into the fire and often into the water. And I brought him to your disciples, but they could not cure him." Jesus answered, "You faithless and perverse generation, how much longer must I be with you? How much longer must I put up with you? Bring him here to me." And Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of him, and the boy was cured instantly. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, "Why could we not cast it out?" He said to them, "Because of your little faith. For truly, I tell you, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you."
What is your mountaintop experience? It doesn't need to have happened on top of a mountain, but of course, maybe it helps if it does. Mine did, on an Icelandic glacial pass on top of a mountain, to be precise. The hike started at the base of a waterfall, led straight up to a glacial pass, then crossed across that glacial pass, and ended in a slow descent through a lush green valley. For most people, it was a 2-day hike. There were 2 cabins along the way to spend the night, one shortly after you'd climbed to the top of the waterfall, and the other about halfway through the pass. Most people chose one or the other in order to split the long distance into 2 days of manageable chunks. My friend and I, however, were going to hike the whole thing in 1 day. What can I say? We were young, and we were Canadian. When we arrived at the first cabin, we stopped in to have a look around. We read the last entries in the cabin's journal. These hikers, apparently, had been caught there in a blizzard that went on for days. Their entries sounded increasingly panicked with each day as the blizzard continued and their food supplies dwindled. Since there were no starved bodies in the cabin, we assumed they eventually got out somehow. In fact, given that the hike for us had so far seemed like a walk in a Winnipeg park, we mostly found these entries kind of humorous. We assumed, of course, that the writers had probably been American. We assumed that the blizzard had been more in their heads than anything. When we exited the cabin, however, the wind had picked up. We were a little more disoriented than we expected. You see, when you're hiking on a path of snow, there isn't an actual path to follow. In this case, there were just yellow poles spread out. In good conditions, you could see the poles spread out ahead of you, and you simply followed the row of markers. Suddenly, we couldn't even see the next one. So, we both stood at our current pole and walked at 2 different angles from that pole until one of us saw the next yellow marker and called out to the other. We did this again and again and again, until before long, we were more fully committed to this hike than we had expected. In addition to the brutal wind, it had started to snow, and the tracks leading us back to the cabin were now long covered. Finding our way back seemed as daunting as finding our way forward. We were now in the middle of a blizzard, in the middle of Icelandic nowhere, making very, very slow progress, fully aware that if the winds or snow worsened, we may very well lose our ability to make any more progress at all. So, we kept going. At some point, we likely passed the second cabin without even realizing it. My friend, who did not believe in God, turned to me and said, for the first time ever, you need to pray for us. I knew that my friend didn't just mean, say something quiet in your head for us. So I prayed out loud. I remember it feeling really raw and vulnerable and almost embarrassing to say a prayer out loud in front of this non-believing friend. Our friendship had virtually been built on an implicit promise that I would never be the kind of Christian friend who offered to pray out loud about stuff. The request, you need to pray for us, went against everything this friendship was premised on. And yet here we were with me praying for our lives, really. And then, just shortly after the prayer ended, we heard voices in the distance coming towards us. And I'm not sure I've ever been so happy to hear the voices of strangers. As the visibility began to increase just ever so much, slowly out of the snow-covered horizon stepped a team of German hikers. We tried to play it cool, but I'm sure our panic was evident as we asked, so how are the conditions up ahead? Totally fine, they told us. Just follow our tracks a little further that way and you'll be out of this snowfall soon. And then they headed into the blizzard and we headed towards the sunshine. And as the sky cleared entirely, we looked up to see the most beautiful rainbow I've ever seen in my life. It was huge, it was bright. To the right, it began on the glacier we'd come from, and to the left, it ended in the lush valley we were headed towards. The hike from there was still incredibly long, and while I don't have time to tell you all about it, I'll simply say that finishing that hike required us to shimmy along a cliff ledge with a safety chain that was no longer a ledge or a safety chain because snow had snowed it over. Then to cross another ledge in a wind so fierce that I couldn't believe it didn't pick me up by the hiking pack and carry me off the mountain. But from the moment we saw that rainbow, every step, probably some of the most dangerous I've taken in my life, was taken with a giddy confidence that someone was most definitely looking out for us and things were going to be just fine. And then just to really top it off, as we finally reached and then descended into that lush green valley, we just kept seeing rainbow after rainbow after rainbow. Every time we turned a corner, there was another one. It was like God was just showing off now. So, when we read today's text and the disciples are on a mountaintop with Jesus and suddenly Jesus' face and clothes appear to start to shine and none other than Moses and Elijah appear and God speaks, this is what I think of. What do you think of? Maybe your mountaintop experience didn't happen on a literal mountain. Maybe you saw or heard God a little less vividly than we did. Or maybe you saw and heard God even more vividly. But when I ask, when have you been the most certain of God's presence and realness? What moments or moments in your life come to mind? When in your life has the everyday come the closest to being transfigured? With you left more certain than you've otherwise been that God is real. Now, I should pause to note that maybe for some of you, nothing comes to mind. In that case, I want to assure you already that this is okay. Some of us will live our earthly lives without such moments. And as will hopefully become clear as I go through the sermon, these moments are not what decide whether or not someone is truly a Christian. But since many of us have had mountaintop, or at least hilltop, experiences where God has felt real like God usually doesn't, I want to spend some time talking about what we do with all of that. In particular, I want to address the fact that such moments can actually eventually do as much to confuse us as they did in the moment to assure us. Because I don't know about you, but I know that I have often struggled with whether or not I have failed in my response to that mountaintop experience. For some reason, I always felt like if I just had an experience just like that one, then I could lay to rest all my doubts about God. I'd never have to deal with them again. But guess what? I still have doubts. And for some reason, I felt like if I had the right mountaintop experience, I'd feel so certain of God's presence that every day of my life would feel full of that kind of giddy, God-filled euphoria that I was full of on that mountain. But guess what? I'm still as nervous and prone to pessimism, judgmental, sad, and angry as ever. For some reason, I also always felt like if I had the right mountaintop experience, I'd spend every day throwing caution to the wind and doing the perfect God thing in every moment. I'd know exactly how to invite every non-Christian I knew to join my church. I'd walk the streets knowing how to show Jesus to everyone on the sidewalk. But guess what? That didn't happen either. In fact, even the very friend I was with that day didn't become a Christian or start going to church. Over time, in fact, that relationship got more and more complicated and messy. We've probably only spoken once in the last 5 years. We might go the rest of our lives without speaking again. So, today, I want to take a closer look at the mountaintop experiences of these disciples, of Peter, James, and John, as well as some of what happens as they come down from the mountaintop. And I want to ask, when we have our own mountaintop experiences, what should we expect in the aftermath? Should we expect to live on the peak and be transformed forever? Or might we expect something a little different? And as well, I've said before at this point in my sermon, spoiler, it'll probably be that something different. So, to start with, I want to highlight a few more elements of Peter, James, and John's mountaintop experience in order to show how well the Bible truly understands those of us who've been to the mountaintop. I've already mentioned the most obvious elements. Jesus' face starts shining like the sun, his clothes become dazzling white, Moses and Elijah appear for a chat. So in that sense, this story captures the vividness of what we feel when we're on the mountaintop. Colors feel brighter. Everything feels bathed in brilliant white light. Things feel both more real and totally surreal at the same time. We feel and see the kinds of stuff we always feel and see, but suddenly they're infused with this deep sense of assurance that the things we hope are true and real are, in fact, true and real. And the Bible even recognizes the deeper nuances of those moments. Notice that the story starts by saying that the transfiguration happens 6 days after the last story it reports, which of course makes this the seventh day, which to its very literate, biblically literate original audience, and hopefully even us, invokes our memory of the seventh day of creation, the day of completion and rest. The Bible, in other words, understands that mountaintop moments feel complete, like everything we believed and hoped for is coming together and being fulfilled, and that in experiencing those moments, we feel at rest. We feel deep peace. In fact, speaking of everything coming together, this story also recognizes that our mountaintop experiences are ones where God's story and our own faith stories feel affirmed, clarified, drawn together. The disciples would have had their doubts about how this new Jesus teacher fit the scriptures and faith they'd been raised in. But then, here are the very pillars of their faith, Moses and Elijah confirming that the story they're living with Jesus is the story of faith they've been taught all along. Mountaintop experiences can do the same for us, filling us with confidence in scripture and our faith story, dispelling the doubts that some of us so often feel about scripture and our own faith walks. Finally, there's this bit about Peter, James, and John being afraid. Now, this may seem like it doesn't fit our own experiences. My mountaintop experience, for example, was about having my fear taken away. But when the Bible talks about things like fearing God, it's often in large part talking about priorities. Fearing God doesn't mean in the Bible so much shaking in your boots. It means recognizing that all the things we put ahead of God need to go back into their place. Sometimes this realization can be frightening in the way we usually mean when we say fear. Putting God ahead of our own anxieties, achievements, and reputations means doing all kinds of things that terrify us. In my mountaintop experience, for example, it meant praying out loud in the person I least wanted to pray out loud in front of. But it's also true that when we think of fear of God as prioritization, the mountaintop fear of God is full of beauty, too. It's an I can see clearly now moment where we feel more sure of what's important and what's not important than we ever have. And that fear can also feel more like what we call relief and inspiration. All of which leads us to the trip down from the mountain. The expectation, of course, is that having seen everything so clearly on the mountaintop, we can now live in utter assurance of God with all of our life perfectly prioritized according to our confidence in God. Maybe we'll get down from the mountain, quit the rat race, just walk the streets zapping people left and right with miracle healings. Which is exactly what we find the disciples doing, right? All right. No. First, on the way down from the mountaintop, the disciples have a somewhat complicated, technical, theological conversation with Jesus about Elijah and John the Baptist. We don't have time to get into it all, but this is basically where Jesus says, look, here's what's coming. The lineage is this. Like Elijah, John the Baptist had to suffer and die. That means it's my turn next. The text doesn't tell us right here how the disciples respond to this news, but just a few verses later in verses 22 and 23, Jesus says it all again. Matthew tells us that the disciples are feeling greatly distressed about all of this. In other words, immediately after the mountaintop experience, where none other than God announces that Jesus is God's beloved son and everything about the disciples' faith feels clearer than ever, the meaning of it starts to get confusing to the disciples. Not seconds after their big epiphany and moment of utter clarity, it doesn't seem to mean what they thought it meant. And then, to really drive home the point, the first thing the disciples do after they get down from the mountaintop is this. They try to heal someone, and they can't pull it off. Coming down from the mountaintop, they try their hand at the most classic gospel-style healing, and they fail miserably. So, just as the Bible recognizes what it is like to be on the mountaintop, the Bible recognizes what it is like to come down from the mountaintop. It recognizes that we do not come down with the eternal confidence and ability to just get it all right. So, what then are we to do with our mountaintop experiences? Well, fortunately, the story can give us some good guidance for that too. It can help us to know what to hold on to and what to let go of from that experience. First, in the midst of the disciples' mountaintop experience, Jesus touches the disciples and tells them not to be afraid. Amidst all the transcendent glory of the moment, Jesus does something very human and everyday. He touches and comforts. Jesus reaches into their moment of otherworld ecstasy and connects it to something very grounded and earthy, a touch of comfort. And more than that, Jesus, recognizing no doubt the doubt that is to come, says, "Do not be afraid." In other words, when we come down from the mountaintop, we can be assured that we won't lose everything about this moment. It unfortunately won't stay with us in the ecstatic, doubt-destroying way we hope it will, but Jesus still presses such moments down into our skin, allowing them to sink in and stay with us, even if on a very subconscious level. So first, hold on to Jesus' touch. Let go of fear. Even if this mountaintop experience doesn't change everything for you, it will change some things, even if subtle and unpredictable things, if you simply accept it as the gift it is. Second, As you hold on to the subtle impact of this moment on the rest of your life, allow yourself to let go of the pressure you'll put on yourself to try to live on the mountaintop. I've sometimes heard preachers say that if you don't feel today like you did on the day that you met Jesus, you're backsliding. Well, if so, then I'll meet you at the bottom of the slide. Because that's not been my experience. And in fact, it's exactly what the disciples try to do, but are foiled from doing by God. Caught up in the mountaintop moment, Peter declares, "I'm going to build dwellings here." In other words, let's set up shop and live on this mountaintop. But the text tells us God literally ignores Peter, overshadows Peter with an actual cloud, and then interrupts, talks over him with a bellowed announcement. God doesn't give Peter's plan to live on the mountaintop the time of day. Doesn't even acknowledge it. As Stanley Hauerwas puts it, like Peter, we desire to secure in place, to tie down and domesticate the wild spirit of God's kingdom. But to do so, he explains, is actually to miss the opportunity to continue to face the new challenges that God puts in front of us. We would like to make the successes of the past our own, he continues, without the courage of those who follow Jesus into the unknown. So, second, it's okay to let go of the need to live on a mountaintop. Related to this is the text's third encouragement. Let go of the pressure to now bring the mountaintop to everyone else. Sometimes after our mountaintop experience, we tell ourselves that God must have given this experience to us so that we can convince everyone else about the realness of God. Now, don't get me wrong. You should share your experiences. There will be opportunities to share them. I'm honored to try to use mine right now to talk about God's goodness. But when we boil our faith experiences down too quickly to the sole purpose of being testimonies to convert or change others, we sometimes end up limiting and pinning them down in a different way. On the way down from the mountain, in fact, Jesus implores the disciples, in this case, not to say anything about what they've just experienced. You think you know what just happened? But you don't, Jesus says. Don't go spouting off about this until you've had the chance to keep learning about it. In other words, when we come down from the mountaintop and immediately decide what it means, we can efficiently turn it into a simplistic testimony. We miss the opportunity to take hold of meanings from it that will come with time. Hauerwas, in fact, goes so far as to suggest that the disciples' failure to heal the epileptic boy was because, as they come down from the mountain, they tried to heal the boy in order to impress people with a big sign from God, to bring a mountaintop to everyone. Faith, Jesus tells them, is not about that big showy stuff. It's the tiny mustard seed stuff. It's humble faith that ends up changing the world. So what does all of this mean? If we hold on to Jesus' gentle, mysterious touch and comfort, but let go of the need to pin down and control our mountaintop experiences, what are we left with? Well, at the very end of their mountaintop experience, the text tells us this. When the disciples looked up, they saw no one but Jesus himself alone. As we come down from the mountain, and as we release the need to pin down or control what's just happened, we are simply left with one calling: keep our eyes on Jesus alone. Since Jesus feels the most real to us on the mountaintop, of course, we often mistake keeping our eyes on Jesus with the very things that we just saw the disciples try to do and fail at. We associate keeping our eyes on Jesus with trying to stay on the mountaintop, or to simplify it into a showy, often formulaic testimony. But in Matthew 17, Easter is around the corner, and Jesus can't stop pointing our eyes towards something else, towards where he's going next, towards the cross. We, of course, would find it much easier if Jesus would just let us build a house with him on that mountaintop. But right before this chapter, and then twice within it, Jesus keeps trying to get it into his disciples' heads. Look at what is going to happen to me. I am going to suffer and die. You want to live on the mountaintop, he's saying, but watch me because my work is in the valley. My work is in the valley where testimonies aren't formulaic, but where humility and openness can lead us to further and further spiritual maturity. My work is in the valley where people's stories are real and messy and complicated and resistant to easy answers. My work is in the valley where there is suffering. My work is in the valley where the tiniest mustard seeds of faith brim with the potential to make the greatest difference. Watch where I go, to the places where testimonies are messy and my children suffer. Watch where I go and then follow me there. See me on the cross and see me in the valley. Yes, bring with you the humble mustard seeds you found on that mountaintop, but come find me in the valley. So today, where in the valley do you see Jesus going? Where in the valley do we as a church family see Jesus going? And what mustard seeds of faith might we try planting along that way?